Welcome in to Outkick the Show. I'm your fearless leader, Clay Travis. I hope all of you are having fantastic Mondays. NFL draft is over. This is why I don't typically go all in bandwagon style on the NHL, because I was asking you guys, hey, should I go all in? Nashville Predators, one of the all-time choke jobs in modern NHL history. For those of you who did not see it, gave up two goals in the final, 2 minutes, missed an open goal off the post, gave up a goal with 8 seconds left, all of it conspiring to lead to ridiculousness. Congratulations to Vancouver on effectively winning that series. We got a lot to talk about. Big polls that are out. CNN has Trump up 6, up 9 with multi-candidates. Harvard-Harris poll has Trump up 5. CBS says Trump leads in Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, down a small amount in Michigan. I'm going to dive into this. I'm going to ask you a question. Why is Trump not the gambling favorite right now, if all of that is true? I'm going to tee off on Howard Stern. I went and listened to the ridiculous interview that he did with Joe Biden. It was an embarrassment. George Washington University is asking for the troops for the police in Washington, D.C. to help in getting rid of the squatters and the protesters. D.C. police say no. DeSantis and Trump have met in Miami, multi-hour meeting reportedly. What does that tell us? Seymour Wiener, World War II vet and New York Mets icon. I love this story. I love everything about it. I'm going to talk about it with you. But we begin... and I'll talk about the NFL draft as well. But we begin with this crazy story out of South Dakota. Kristi Noem on the VP shortlist. And she writes in her book that she shot a 14-month-old dog or puppy, however you want to classify it, because the dog was attacking chickens. And she uses it as a metaphor to argue that she will make tough decisions and that that's what you have to do sometimes on the ranch. I asked all of you, to be fair, poll question is up. A lot of strong opinions here. Does Kristi Noem, and we just talked about it a lot on Clay and Buck, does Kristi Noem writing about shooting a 14-month-old dog on her ranch, a dog she says attacked a neighbor's chickens and needed to be put down, make you less likely to vote for her? Yes, 39%. No, 61%, with over 10,000 votes in right now. This surprises me somewhat. I think there's a natural reflectiveness to defend when situations like these occur, and I think that is likely to be what is underway here, if I had to predict why exactly this is going on. But ultimately, I think this is a failure of Kristi Noem. Much of politics is about the stories that you choose to tell and how you tell them. It doesn't mean that every human is perfect or every human always makes the right decisions. But if you are trying to appeal to a large audience, what might have some appeal to ranchers in South Dakota doesn't necessarily translate to moms in Tampa or to Scottsdale, Arizona, when it comes to thinking about animals. And so I've told the story before. If you look closely at me, other side right here, I've got a pretty big scar that still has that's still very visible on the right side of my face. When I was 6 years old, I got bitten by a German Shepherd in my friend's backyard. We were there with chicken pox. The dog leapt up, bit me across the face. You think about how small a six-year-old is. The bone was visible on my cheek here. There was a hole in my cheek. My lip was split all the way open. 6 years old. Dog Casper, German Shepherd. I did nothing to it. Just reached down, petted him on the head. He jumped up and bit half my face off. So As a young kid, you can imagine I was no great fan of dogs. Now, we had dogs, but when you're little, dogs are very close to your face. I did not grow up based on that, having a great experience with decent-sized dogs. Now, I'm 6 foot now. I don't have any fear of dogs that is massive or substantial because I'm a lot bigger than most dogs. But so I'm not someone who reflexively likes dogs more than people. So I'm not someone, I understand that there's a lot of you out there that are hardcore dog lovers, hardcore cat lovers. I wouldn't put myself in that category. I'm a pro-human person over animals, okay? But I think this is a real failure. I think this is a failure of Kristi Noem not to contemplate how the stories that you tell about your life impact the way that people think about you. And I'll give you an example. Bill Clinton didn't try to argue that getting a blowjob from an intern made him somehow impacted his decision-making. As in, you should trust me more based on the fact that I got a blowjob from an intern. There are probably lots of things that Kristi Noem has done as governor that would be reflective of her governance strategies that she could tell through a story. Killing a dog, to me, is not the way to do this. And so I think it's an unforced error that makes her less likable and less likely to be Donald Trump's vice presidential choice. I really do. And the betting markets reflect that. I was talking about this earlier today because I do think the betting markets in many ways reflect the larger universe. And I like to go to Polymarket, which is a huge betting market. They have all sorts of stuff. Hundreds of millions of dollars. I'll talk about them in a little bit more when it comes to their numbers. Tim Scott right now is the favorite to be picked as the vice president by Trump. Elise Stefanik is in second place. J.D. Vance, Nikki Haley, Ben Carson, Marco Rubio are all 5% or less. Kristi Noem, who used to be the favorite, is now down to 3%. Ron DeSantis, I'll talk about this in a moment, 3%. Vivek, 2%. Pompeo, 2%. Sarah Huckabee Sanders, 2%. Katie Britt, 2%. RFK Jr., 2%. Byron Donalds, Lee Zeldin, Mike Pence, that's funny, Tucker Carlson. A lot of these people, less than 1%. But you can go bet on a large variety of potential VP contenders. I think this takes Kristi Noem off the board as a vice presidential contender. I really do. I think it's an unforced error. I think it's an unflattering introduction for her to much of the nation. And I think it reflects a poor decision-making, not only by her and her team, because remember, it's in her autobiography. She didn't have to tell this story. And when I was doing sports all the time, a lot of coaches are big fans. And so we would have, you know, off the record conversations over the years. And I would talk sometimes on my show and say, I'm not a fan of drug testing. I've said this for a long time. I think if you're an adult, you shouldn't be tested for non-performance enhancing drugs. In other words, I didn't care if you smoked pot. Frankly, I don't care if you use cocaine. I don't think you should. But I don't think it should be the job of your employer to be checking to see whether or not you're using drugs. Again, my personal opinion. I think in almost every job, if you're using drugs, that will reveal itself. Now, I made exceptions. If you drive vehicles, for instance, if you're a truck driver, yeah, I would want you tested because I don't want you putting other people at risk, right? But in terms of a football player, where your job is just to play football, if you're not doing it well and you're using performance non-enhancing drugs, I think eventually you'll lose your job to somebody who is doing better. And similarly, I you know, don't think, for instance, I should be drug tested. I don't use drugs, but if I did, I think my performance over time would be poor, and so you guys would know, and I would not show up for work, and I wouldn't be as good as I otherwise would because it would dull my mind, and I wouldn't be as effective at doing my job. That's my theory. You guys can agree or disagree. But when I had conversations about this with coaches and executives, a lot of them said, Clay, that's interesting, but you're missing something. to us, it's not necessarily back in the day about whether or not you smoke pot. It's about whether you treat this as a significant enough concern that you're smart enough to pass the test. In other words, they said a failed drug test told them that you weren't serious about your job and that there was something that was amiss in terms of your commitment to doing your job. And so that I understood. I thought about it and I said, okay, that's kind of an interesting analogy. I would apply it here for Kristi Noem. What it tells you is something about her preparation and ability to advance beyond the governorship onto a national stage. I think it's a failure of she and her advisors to correctly handle and manage a situation and not create an unforced error. So I think this is significant. Couple of other things. So that's my thoughts on the Kristi Noem dog shooting element. I think there's a lot of people out there who will reflexively defend someone because they see it as tribal. I don't really see that as my job. I'm going to tell you exactly what I think. I'm going to analyze things fairly. Kristi Noem, she may end up being VP. I think this wasn't an unforced error by her. Flip side, let me give some praise here. In the same way that I've been critical of Nikki Haley, because I think Nikki Haley's advisors led her the wrong way when she didn't drop out of the race after getting waxed in New Hampshire. She then went to South Carolina, got crushed, decided to run on Super Tuesday, basically got whipped everywhere except, what, D.C. and Vermont. I think she won those primaries. I think she harmed herself by staying in the race for too long. After DeSantis put all his eggs in the basket in Iowa and lost substantially, I gave credit to Ron DeSantis because he dropped out of the race and he endorsed Trump. Now, Trump and DeSantis have met in Miami. To me, the ultimate dream Republican ticket, now there are complicating factors because they both are from Florida, but beyond a shadow of a doubt, the most qualified person in my mind to be Trump's vice president is Ron DeSantis. I don't know that he would want the job. And again, there are constitutional concerns associated with both Trump and DeSantis being from Florida. One of them would need to move to a different state. I think beyond a shadow of a doubt, Ron DeSantis would be the best possible vice presidential choice for Trump. Again, I don't know that they're willing, that he's willing to take the job. I'm not sure that the constitutional issues with both being from the same state would allow it or permit it to occur. But if I were just looking right now and saying, who is the best possible vice presidential choice? I think it's Ron DeSantis. I give credit to DeSantis for dropping out of the race once he knew he wasn't going to win, for not being a sore loser, and for now meeting with Trump in Miami and reportedly agreeing to help raise money for Trump in his campaign here in 24. I think DeSantis is going to be one among many who will be at the top of the list to be potentially the nominee in 2028. We will see exactly how all of this ends up shaking out. But I think if you were asking me, I think it's going to be Tim Scott. But who is the most prepared to be vice president? To me, it is Ron DeSantis. I think he would be the best pick. Polling. What we're seeing right now is Trump has opened a substantial lead. Whatever bounce, if any, Joe Biden got from the State of the Union has vanished. CNN over the weekend, Trump is up 6, 49-43, up 9 if you consider multi-candidates, RFK, Jill Stein, Carnell West, and others. CBS poll that came out. Trump leads in Pennsylvania and Wisconsin, down by a small margin in Michigan. Harvard-Harris poll that just came out about an hour ago. Trump is up 5, 48-43 in that nationwide poll. What's going on here? If Trump is, and it's clear the case that he is, up nationally in the polls, why is Biden favored right now in the polymarket polls? Now, I understand the battleground states. Some of you can say, well, when you actually look at the battleground states, there's more challenges there. But if you look right now, presidential election winner 2024, $12 million at Polymarket has been bet on Joe Biden, 45%. Donald Trump, 11.3 million bet on him, 44%. A lot of money bet on Michelle Obama, believe it or not. Nearly 8 million bet on Michelle Obama. RFK Jr., 6 million bet on him. Kamala Harris, 4 million bet on her. So if you add up all of the Democrat candidates, you get to 50%. And then Trump gets 44%, and then RFK Jr. would get 4%. There's other dollars built bet elsewhere. Why the disconnect between the gambling markets and the polls? I think it's a fascinating question. Why is Biden favored in the gambling markets and not favored in any of the battleground states in polling right now, and not favored in the nationwide polls? What's going on here? Either one of two things. One, the gambling markets are saying we don't believe the polls. We don't think the polls are accurate, and therefore the money is coming in and telling us a little bit different of a story than what the polls are. 6 months out, okay, I can buy that argument on some level. The other one, though, is there's something that we don't know, that the markets know. Because the markets are not reflecting what the polls are telling us. Now, so what's going on here? Now, one possibility is it's a relatively small amount of money at stake. Maybe there are people out there that want to boost Biden, and they're willing to pay a couple of million dollars in the gambling markets to do it. That's an intriguing idea, right? When you consider that there's going to be billions of dollars spent on the gamble the political ads, if you think people like Clay Travis are going to pay attention to the gambling markets and use it as a proxy, you might say, let's invest several million dollars in propping up Biden because maybe it helps him raise more money. I just think it's an interesting possibility. But the thing that moved recently was Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania kind of moved as a tandem. Trump is favored to win Georgia pretty substantially. He's favored to win North Carolina pretty substantially. And he's favored to win Arizona. If that is true, and he's going to win all three of those, as the gambling markets are telling us, then all Trump would need to do is maybe win Nevada, or he could win one of Wisconsin, Michigan, or Pennsylvania. It doesn't add up. There's an incongruity happening here because Biden almost has to run the table in the Midwest, or he's going to lose probably based on the markets, yet the markets are telling us that Biden's a substantial favorite. Now, maybe the idea is, well, the Midwest vote, whatever happens, one guy's going to win all three. That a split is unlikely. We're likely to see what happened in 16-20 again, right? Trump won all three of those states in 16. Biden won all three of those states in 20. Maybe there's enough overlap between Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin that it's unlikely one of those states is going to have a different result than the rest. Okay, I can accept that. But why would Biden, when his numbers are underwater in most of those state polls, be favored in this race? It doesn't add up. So I just want to kind of put that out there as, hey, pay attention to what's going on here. The gambling markets are telling us something different than the individual state betting markets somewhat are, but then the polls certainly are. I think it's worth putting a pin in and thinking about it. University protest. I don't know right now. There may be arrests going on campuses. I know there was a deadline at Columbia. I know that NYU and UCLA and USC and all these different schools have had issues coast to coast, including my alma mater, George Washington, which I'm going to get to in a moment. But let me tell you something here that I think is happening at UCLA and I would encourage this to happen everywhere. If they are going to permit these protesters to put up tents and stay on these campuses, I saw this at UCLA, more power to them. At UCLA, they put up a jumbotron, sort of a screen, and they are playing the atrocities of October 7th committed, perpetrated by Hamas against Jewish people on loop. I think it's nasty that we need to publicize this, but I give credit to UCLA. If that is what is required in order to put this in front of the college kids and see what they are actually protesting for, they need to see what happened and what Israel's responding to, and maybe some of these knucklehead college kids just don't know. So I give praise for this idea being underway and being done in the fashion in which it is. To me, that may well be necessary to kind of shock some of these knucklehead college kids out of their ignorance. And I give credit for the fact that that is allegedly occurring. Couple of other things that are out there associated with this. I went to George Washington University. There is a report that George Washington University has requested DC police to come in and clear the protesters. And if that were to happen, the quad would be free of protesters, but you'd still be able to protest whatever you wanted. Again, I went to GW. They gave me a scholarship. I'm an alum. How is it that the D.C. Police Department is refusing to come in and do this? GW has reportedly requested help in these protesters being removed from campus. The D.C. Police won't do it. That's a sign that the D.C. Police, or at least the political class there, is saying we support these protests. I think that's a really bad precedent. I would also point out, I went to GW, and according to the Hillel website, there are 28% Jewish students at GW. That's a huge percentage. One of the highest percentages of Jewish students in the entire country. Jewish populations, a couple of percent nationwide. So we're talking about 14, 15x the actual population of Jewish people. I think it was higher than that when I went to GW. I feel like it was nearly half Jewish, huge percentage Jewish. That, to me, means the anti-Israel protest hit differently at a school like GW with a huge Jewish population than they would some of these other campuses. And I think that that is seen as a direct attack on Jewish students by many. Now, I don't believe you should be able to put a tent out on campus no matter what your politics are. But if there were tent campuses at Columbia or at GW because students were upset that Donald Trump had been charged with crimes and was facing time in prison right now, do you think that the universities would allow those encampments to continue? Or do you think they would come in and clear all those students out? I think you know the answer. If there was an encampment arguing that the KKK was being treated unfairly, do you think they would be allowed to stay on campus? If there was an encampment arguing that gay marriage should be ended, do you think that those protesters would be allowed to stay there? We need content-neutral policies that don't allow trespass. And that's why I want to give credit for what I saw over the weekend. Greg Abbott at Texas, Governor Brian Kemp of Georgia, Ron DeSantis of Florida, Bill Lee of Tennessee, among others, have essentially said at Vanderbilt, at Emory, at any of the universities in Florida, or at the University of Texas at Austin, which I believe maybe Rice as well, have seen campus protests. We're not going to stand for this. We're not going to allow it. Content-neutral policies. I don't want anybody arrested because of what they're saying, unless it's a direct actionable threat. I don't want anybody arrested because they happen to believe that the war shouldn't be able to continue in Israel. But I do want content-neutral policies to be applied. So if you would be arrested, if you were camping out saying gay marriage shouldn't be legal, for instance, then why in the world should you not also be arrested for camping out, trespassing on university property, and arguing that the war in Israel is illegitimate? I thought the University of Florida, go Gators, put out a good policy under Ben Sasse. A couple of more things. Howard Stern praising Joe Biden. In an hour-long interview, I went and listened to it. I could not believe how much of a sycophant Howard Stern has become of people in power. It was an embarrassing interview. Joe Biden provided a litany of lies. I thought Will Cain and Pete Hegseth did a good job on their weekend show of doing a deep dive into all the lies that Biden has told, including recently that his uncle was eaten by cannibals and that he was arrested for being on the front porch during a civil rights movement. Joe Biden in the 1970s said he didn't want his kids to be educated in racial jungles. And you're telling me when he was a teenager that he was standing on front porches protesting for civil rights? I mean, this is just a lie. But Howard Stern had an opportunity to ask basic questions and actually get interesting answers. And instead, he kissed up to Joe Biden. I had a clip that I shared over the weekend of Stern saying that Biden was one of the best presidents that he could possibly imagine, and he was so proud that he was president of the United States. It's a disgrace. Howard Stern is 70 years old, COVID broken. He didn't leave his house for years. He allowed COVID to turn him into everything that he would have ridiculed in the 1990s and the 2000s. And my hope is that, and I pledge to you, that I hope I retire before I become a shell of myself on the radio. I'm 45. I would like to think that if I want to do it, I've got 20 good years minimum to continue to be able to talk to people on a daily basis, as long as I have the energy and health to be able to do so. But I've also already talked to my wife. I said, hey, you'll probably see it before others will. If you see me starting to lose my fastball, let me know. I don't want to become a shell of myself. I don't want to lose my ability to make the arguments well that I've been making for now, whatever it is, 15 years of being on the radio roughly daily. I hope I got another 20 years. I hope I can go 30 or 35 years of excellent radio. But if I lose the ability, or I start to become a shell of myself, or I turn into a complete and total hypocrite, and I'm not able to advocate for the beliefs that I have, I hope I don't turn into Howard Stern. I've got enough money. I've had enough success. I can leave before I get bad. I want to prolong the peak. What did I see? The Wall Street Journal says decision-making tends to peak at the age of 57. That is the what the data reflects. Obviously, there's differences on both sides. That would mean I still got another decade or so to get better, and then I would hope I can Tom Brady this thing, LeBron James this thing, and have a prolonged stretch of excellence before I begin to decline. I would hope that I'm able to do that. Finally, this is a great story. I want to end with something positive. The New York Mets honored a 97-year-old World War II veteran. His name, Seymour Wiener. When the video of him being honored at a Mets game went viral, it became super memed. The 97-year-old veteran and his family have a great sense of humor about it. And when this all went viral, they appreciated it. They had a lot of laughs associated with it. I'm glad this guy has such a great humor, great sense of humor. It's probably why he's lived to 97. And again, he fought in World War II. I mean, he's a national hero. But his family loved it so much. He's a big Mets fan. They brought him back, the Mets did, to help promote Dollar Hot Dog Night at Citi Field in New York. And so, again, Seymour Wiener, we salute you. We thank you for your service. And there's no better person to be speaking out on behalf of hot dogs. If I owned a hot dog company, I would be signing Seymour Wiener right now to be my national spokesperson. I would put him in television campaigns. I would have him everywhere. Because after all, what's better than seeing more wieners? Pause. I appreciate all of you. DBAP, unless you need to SBAP. I am Clay Travis. This has been Outkick, the show. I'll see you all tomorrow.